Good morning. Well, this morning, I'd just like to get right to it. Talk a little bit about what a strange time we're in. We all know that. I think this is the strangest time I've seen in my life. And, you know, things are going okay. I feel like for me, my practice is serving me well. I know what to do. I have a practice that I've been following for a long time, and I find that following those same things is very helpful and very meaningful for me. And so in a sense, I know what to do. But at the same time, I have to ask myself, what is my Zen practice right now? And sometimes I have this kind of, you know, nagging longing to kind of make sense of it all. And kind of, you know, I ask myself, well, what is it today? What is my approach today? What is it I need to do? And those answers don't always come. And I'd like to acknowledge that is the situation. I think that may be true for many of us. So I think practice right now for many of us is something about being open, about being comfortable with not knowing, maybe being comfortable with discomfort. I think our practice has to do maybe with not having too many expectations, about not adding to the suffering that is already there by expecting things to be a certain way. Oh, I should be this way, but I'm not. What's wrong with me today? Being open, seeing things new, not having unrealistic expectations, all of those things can help. And this morning, to help me think about these questions a little bit, I'm going to talk about one of the most familiar stories in Buddhism. And this is the story of the Buddha leaving the palace for the first time and what he saw, the four sights, also known as the four signs. So this is a story about something that happened a long time ago, but I think it's relevant for what we're doing now. Many of you are very familiar with this story. There are a lot of versions of it out there. The version I'm relying on this morning is from the Buddhacharita, or the Deeds of the Buddha, and it's attributed to Ashvaghosha and was written between the first and second centuries. And it appears in this book called The Buddhist Tradition. And this is my copy. When I buy a book, I usually write my name in it and when I bought it. And this one says September 1974. So I've had this book for 46 years. It's holding up pretty well. It's kind of getting that old book smell. You know, today, one of my themes is going to be making practice new. But I gotta say that even though we need to make our practice new, there are certain things that we carry forward for a long time, like an old Dharma book or maybe an old Dharma friend that really feel good. And that stuff is okay, too. Anyway, this book says that Ashvaghosha drew on authoritative accounts of the Buddha's life, which had been some 600 years earlier. It says that Ashvaghosha rejected some of the more extravagant stories that had grown up. But his account is still pretty extravagant, as you will see. It's implausible, and it's fantastical, with gods intervening and things like that. But that's okay. It's a story that reveals a truth about human existence. Doesn't really matter whether it's literally true or not. So first we have to understand the prophecy, which many of you are very familiar with. The Buddha's father was the king. By the way, I'll probably refer to him as the Buddha out of habit, even though he's not the Buddha yet. I should probably call him the prince. That's what Ashvaghosha calls him. But anyway, the Buddha's father was a king. When he knew the Buddha was, when he knew he was going to have a child, he called upon a soothsayer to come in and give him a prophecy. And this person said that the coming child would either grow up to be a great king, a great worldly leader, or a great seeker of the truth, meaning a holy person. Well, the king wanted his child to grow up to be just like him, as parents often do. So he wanted him to be a king. He did not want him to seek the holy life. So he decided the way to keep him from seeking a holy life was to shield him from all pain and suffering. If he doesn't know about suffering, why would he want to go on a spiritual path? So he kept him in the palace, didn't let him go out, gave him every kind of entertainment, shielded him from all kinds of suffering. But on one occasion, the prince heard about woods filled with songs abounding in fresh grass, with trees in which the cuckoo sounded, adorned with many lotus ponds. He heard someone talking about these beautiful things. He wanted to go out, and the prince, like a pent-up elephant, entertained the thought of going out of the palace. And so he asked the king, "May I go out of the palace?" The king says, "Okay." But the king wants to control that experience. He orders all commoners who have any kind of an affliction to be kept off the royal road. So he's showing him something phony. The prince mounts a golden chariot, goes out with his charioteer, Chana, and he sees the royal way filled with well-behaved citizens wearing clean and simple clothes, and everything looks good. But the gods intervene. The Shuddhadevasa gods are watching this, and they want the prince to become a holy person. So they are going to undermine the king's efforts, and they create someone which they send for the Buddha to see. And so the prince sees him, and it is a man overcome with old age. He has never seen an old person before. Hard to believe. Weren't there old people in the palace? But that's okay. He looks at this old person and he says, "O charioteer, who is this man with gray hair, supported by a staff in his hand, his eyes sunken under his eyebrows, his limbs feeble and bent? Is this transformation a natural state or an accident?" The charioteer knows that he's not supposed to tell the truth to the prince, but the gods confuse his intelligence. So he just blurts out the truth, and he says, "Yep, it's old age. It's the destroyer of beauty and vigor, the source of sorrow. This man has been ruined by old age." The prince asks, "Will this evil come upon me also?" And Chana says, "It certainly will." For a long while, the prince kept his gaze on the decrepit man, sighing and shaking his head. And he says despondently, "I get it. Old age destroys memory, beauty, and strength. Yet people in the world are not disturbed at seeing such a sight. How can that be?" And he's overcome with grief, and he goes back to the palace. He can't take it anymore. And then he broods about it, and he broods about it, and he needs to go out for a second trip. And he does. And this time, the gods create a man whose body was affected by disease. And he asks his charioteer, "Who is this man whose abdomen is swollen and whose body quivers as he breathes? His shoulders and arms are limp, his legs are pale and emaciated. Lean for support, he is crying out, mother. And Shauna answers, Lord, this is the great misfortune called disease. The Buddha asks, is this peculiar to him or does it happen to everybody? Charioteer says, everybody gets sick. The prince became despondent and trembled like the moon reflected on the waves of water. He realizes this calamity affects all people, and yet people seem unconcerned, and vast is the ignorance of people who laugh when they themselves have not been released from the danger of sickness. Then the same gods produced the third sight, which was a corpse. And a similar process happens. The Buddha realizes what death is. He asks if it's going to happen to him. He finds out it is. He says, this is the inescapable end for all people. Yet people feel unconcerned. So those are the first three sights. The fourth sight happens a little later. The Buddha, after seeing this third sight, he goes home and he enters in really his first meditation because he's so distraught. He's never had a reason to meditate before. He hasn't had any problems. But he sits and he meditates, and I think he's a natural at it. And his mind becomes firm and he is released from mental distractions. And he becomes filled with extreme joy and bliss. And then he meditates on the course of the world and he sees clearly all of the evils of the world. And he's in a passionless, pure insight into these things. And a person appears to him. It's a mendicant, a beggar, a wandering monk. And the prince says, who are you? He says, I'm a mendicant who has renounced the world for the sake of deliverance. I search for a blessed and indestructible state. I am free from the evils of passion arising from the objects of sense. Living wherever I happen to be, at the foot of a tree, in a deserted house, in the mountains or in the woods, I wander about, living on the alms I receive, without ties to person or place, and with no expectations. Saying this, the mendicant then flew to the sky as the prince watched. So he had been sent by the gods as well. The prince now knew what he should do and began thinking of a way to leave his home. Excuse me a second. There, that's quieter. Good. I can talk in my quiet voice. So the fourth sight is really important here because it gave rise in the Buddha's mind to the idea that there must be a way out of suffering because this guy purported not to be suffering. And so the Buddha resolved to seek that. He soon left the palace. He found the best teachers of his time. He learned from them. He moved on. He had a disciplined practice for many years, and eventually he became enlightened, and he solved this problem of suffering, and he began to teach. So one of the best, I think the best commentary on this story I've ever read is by Karen Armstrong in her book, Buddha, which is a wonderful book. Karen Armstrong is a former Catholic nun. She's not a Buddhist. She's written about many different religions. She really gets what the Buddha was about and really places him in a context of the axial age and what else was going on there. And she says that this story of leaving the palace is an archetype applicable to all people. It doesn't purport to be historically sound. It's overtly mythological, but it's a paradigm of spirituality. Everyone who seeks spiritual transformation or spiritual anything has to go through a transformative experience. They have to see what they're lacking in order to begin their spiritual quest. And she says, I'm reading just a short portion of a paragraph here. She says, the king decided to shield his son from these disturbing sights. Guards were posted around the palace to keep all upsetting reality at bay, and the boy became a virtual prisoner, even though he lived in luxury and had an apparently happy life. Gotama's pleasure palace is a striking image of a mind in denial. As long as we persist in closing our minds and hearts to the universal pain, which surrounds us on all sides, we remain locked in an undeveloped version of ourselves, incapable of growth and spiritual insight. The young Siddhartha was living in a delusion, since his vision of the world did not coincide with the way things really were. And then she says that once he has seen the four sights, a shift had occurred in Gotama's view of the world. Now that he was aware of the suffering that lay in wait for every single being, without exception, everything seemed ugly, even repellent. The veil that had concealed life's pain had been torn aside. How oppressive and stifling it is, Gotama exclaimed. He leaped out of bed and resolved to go forth that very night. So it's a wonderful metaphor. I think it's not very plausible that he knew nothing about suffering and then suddenly learned about all of it. But it's a wonderful metaphor for how our eyes open and we gradually became aware of things. And then sometimes there's a tipping point that might drive us toward taking up some kind of practice because we realize this is serious business. And I'm sure many of you could tell me stories of how this process has worked for you. Maybe it was gradual, but maybe there was something sudden. Maybe some external event came. And I know that great suffering preceded my own commitment to this practice. The veil that had concealed things was torn aside. And it seems to me that this is something we can really relate to at the present time. Because with the things going on now, with coronavirus and the upcoming election and the uncertainty about that, and the struggle for racial equality, and the things we've learned about dysfunction in our nation and some of the cruelty that underlies so much of our system and the strength of that. It's like we're having our eyes opened anew. We thought we knew suffering. We thought we knew all about that. And yet here we're seeing it on a deeper level, maybe personally and on a societal level as well. And maybe our usual ways of dealing with this are not working so well. And maybe we're confused about that. So maybe we're a little stunned. And I think right now, we're kind of like the Buddha looking at a sick man for the first time. What is this? What do we do with this? And we see a sick world. We've seen the sights on a personal level. We've seen them on a societal level. For a long time, the prince kept his gaze on the decrepit man, sighing and shaking his head. And later, the prince became despondent and trembled like the moon reflected on the waves of water. And we may be feeling like this. We may be sometimes disappointed in ourselves with our response to it all. We may have some of how we should be, and our actions may not match that picture. I've had my days where I didn't quite meet my ideal. Now, I don't want to overstate this. I talk to a lot of people, and I think that people are coping really well and finding the strength and doing what needs to be done. But I do think it's important to recognize the full range of emotions that we're having. If we can't recognize here with our Zen friends in a Dharma talk that it's pretty hard, where are we going to recognize that? Now, I truly believe we have the strength to get through this. We have our practice and we have each other. But I'm not going to be superficial and pretend that it's not hard. And here's the point. Of course, we don't have to stay here staring at the sick man. The Buddha didn't stay there staring and shaking his head in consternation forever. He went forth and he resolved to do something about it. And that's the point of Buddhism. Buddhism is about suffering and the relief of suffering. So what did the prince do? The fourth sight is the key. The key to ending suffering. The prince saw the mendicant. Now he knew what he should do, meaning he would begin his spiritual practice. And that's what he did. So if we're identifying with the Buddha in the story here a little bit, we've come forward in our story. Maybe we're no longer looking at the sick man. Instead, we're looking at the wandering monk and we're wondering what to do. What do we do now? And I have some thoughts about that briefly that I would like to talk about. What can we learn from the Buddha in this moment of resolve to become a wandering monk? What do we have in common with him at that point? Well, something that's a little different is the Buddha began his spiritual quest at that very point. We've had a spiritual quest because the Buddha lived and other spiritual personages live. We have been pursuing a practice for a long time. It didn't hit us all at once. But it's important for us to remember that our practice is also new. Like the Buddha who suddenly had a practice, like suddenly I need to change everything about my life and devote myself in a new way. We have that newness too. I mean, we have that newness every day. I'm not suggesting we change everything about our life today, but I am suggesting that that is basic to our practice, that we see things anew all the time. Yes, we've got our old books, which we cherish, and our learning, which has served us well. And we have an established practice, and we have maybe routines, and those things are great. We take refuge in all of this stuff. But also, things are different, and we need to adjust. And sometimes I'll talk to people who ask, you know, how come my practice isn't working the way it did before? Or maybe they say, you know, I've got this opportunity right now to be a perfect monk and I'm not doing it. I'm not doing it. I'm lazy. I don't have what I should have. Or, you know, where's my energy for my practice? And when we talk it through, we usually conclude, well, it's probably time to try some new things, shake things up a little bit. Maybe we don't have the same energy as before. Maybe we really need more time right now to recharge. And that's fine. Take that time to recharge, whatever it is that helps you with that. Some things may be a little relaxing, but not recharging, you know, like watching TV is not so good, but finding something you enjoy doing, something maybe routine, for me, you wouldn't believe how much time I've spent weeding my lawn. I think my neighbors all think I'm really strange, but I find that really relaxing. It's when I pull weeds, I just fall into something where the thoughts come in and I spend some time with them and then they go again. And it's a wonderful mindful activity. So, it's not about the weeds in my yard. It's about the weeds in my mind. And actually, I love the weeds in my mind. I don't pull them. I don't have to. I just let them visit. And then they kind of voluntarily leave again. So that's a very helpful thing, to engage in those mindful activities or going for walks. We don't want to constrict ourselves with an idea of what our practice should be. We want to make our practice new, like the Buddha did. He left the palace, he cut his hair, he gave away his clothes, and he must have asked himself, what now? That's our question, what's now? Second, I think it's good to accept that it's quite normal not to come up right away with a good answer to how we should be. You may try some things that don't work. The Buddha's path was long and arduous, and it didn't always work for him either. He spent years in an ascetic practice, starving himself, driving himself nearly to the point of death. And ultimately, he learned that all of that had not been necessary, that the middle way was the answer. He had gotten it wrong. So that's okay. It's going to happen. We're going to get it wrong. We can accept that life is going to be disappointing and chaotic. So three, remember the middle path. And that's what the Buddha discovered when he realized that asceticism wasn't helpful. You can't be too relaxed and too loose, or you won't really have a spiritual life at all. But you also can't be too tight. You need enough well-being to do your practice well. And that's how it is for us now. We have to work on our well-being. One person told me, you know, I don't feel very spiritual right now. Basically, I'm just surviving now. That's all I've got the energy for. Well, it is what it is, right? Maybe you lack the energy to do your usual version of your spiritual practice. So, of course, you accept that. That's true. And you work within that situation. You give yourself to survival. That's your practice. That's not taking time off from practice. So let's not add to the suffering by thinking our practice should be different, that we should be in some ideal monastery, being an ideal monk. No, we're in the 2020 monastery. It's a new kind of monastery that's never been seen before, and we're inventing it. So the choices we make on what to do may not seem overtly spiritual. But if we choose to go for a walk or a bike ride rather than sitting home, watching TV, say, it's a choice to be present rather than caught in our head. If you're making that choice to be present, that's a spiritual activity. And the fourth thing is asking, what is it now? And that is the essence of Zen practice. That's kind of become my mantra. I talk about that a lot. But we can take kind of a Zen view of the Buddha's path. We can say it was not so much that he was transcending samsara and arriving at nirvana, but rather that he found them to be the same. So the Buddha practiced in a continuous present, saying again and again, what is it now? So those are the four things. Remember that like the prince, we have a practice that is new. This practice may be chaotic. That's okay. Remember the middle way and remember to ask, what is it now? Keep it new. And I think that these four things add up to a quiet, forgiving, loving practice. And we will keep at it we will get through it. I know we will.